From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the January 2018 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Turning Points. As it's January, it's time to take stock and look at the year ahead. 75 years ago, it was January 1943. We now know the end of the war was in sight, but not even the intelligence chiefs at Bletchley Park knew that then. But things were starting to look up. By December 1942, Hut 8 had broken back into the naval Enigma codenamed Shark after a devastating 10-month blackout, which had been prompted by extra security added by a rightly suspicious Admiral Dönitz and ended by a daring raid on a sinking submarine, which cost the lives of two brave sailors but made for a huge turning point in the Battle of the Atlantic. Elsewhere, the end of the Battle of Stalingrad was another huge turning point. After 5 grueling months, the German army finally surrendered against Hitler's wishes. They'd been surrounded and eventually starved out, not to mention running out of ammunition. But not before up to 2 million people were either killed, injured, or captured. There's an intelligence story to tell about both of these turning points and more, all in 1943. Back at Bletchley Park, things were developing fast. Solid brick blocks had been built and the workers by now were moving in, this showing a serious commitment to codebreaking as part of the war effort. Let's look into all of this and more with Bletchley Park's research historian, Dr. David Kenyon.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
This time last year, David, we were looking back at 1942 as a year as a whole, and it was pretty grim at the beginning of the year, but it was the year that things really started to turn round, didn't they?
Very much so, yeah. I mean, when we spoke a year ago, we were talking about Pearl Harbor had just happened, Singapore had fallen, Britain was still more or less on its own in the war, and things were looking pretty bleak. 12 months on, partly due to the involvement of the Americans, but massively as well due to the Russians, the situation has changed quite markedly. That's reflected actually in General Alan Brooke, who was the chief of the Imperial General Staff, so basically the senior soldier and consulting with Churchill. He wrote at the time, "We start 1943 under conditions I would never have dared to hope. Russia has held. Egypt for the present is safe." He's talking about the success at El Alamein, which we spoke about in October, which is the high point of the German advance in North Africa. And from that point on, they are massively on the retreat. Also, from sort of August onwards, you've had the German advance to Stalingrad, which was ultimately defeated at huge cost to the Germans. So Alan Brooke could see this sense that the tide had turned and things were now going well for the Allies in a way they hadn't up to that point.
Britain's gallant 8th Army roars over the ancient and arid terrain of North Africa to drive Rommel and his armies into the sea. Under a troubled African sky, General Bernard Montgomery continues to be master of all that he surveys. General Fontoma, Rommel's second in command, routed out of Libya and with his back to the jagged walls of Africa's desolate coastal range, surrenders with his beaten and shell-shocked troops to the victors. Films captured from the Germans show Marshal Rommel at a more tranquil moment. Little did the Desert Fox then realize that the hunters were breaking through on all fronts.
Is it fair to say that everybody involved by now knew they were in very deep? And that, I mean, there was no kind of, well, this time next year, this will be a memory sort of thinking. Nobody thought it was nearly over at this point. Am I right in saying that?
I think that's fair. I mean, there's the sense that exactly that, that it's going to be a long haul, that, I mean, it's already been 3 years by that point. And you see it at Bletchley, there's this sense that things aren't being done as a sort of temporary, extemporized thing for the next 6 months. They're planning for years into the future. And doesn't only apply at Bletchley, it applies across the board. And once the Americans are fully involved as well, that gives a different character to the war, because with Operation Torch, it's the first time that they have soldiers directly fighting the Germans, for example.
So what was Operation Torch then?
Operation Torch is a mostly American invasion of North Africa, the western end of North Africa, so Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. And there's two sets of landings. There's one set that happen on the Atlantic coast of Morocco, sort of outside the Straits of Gibraltar. And then there's other landings that happen in Algeria and Tunisia on the inside. And the idea there is that the Germans in North Africa are then squeezed between two fires. You've got Montgomery coming from Egypt in one direction, and you've got these American and British forces coming from the west. And that is ultimately successful. And by May, it's all up for the Germans in North Africa. But it also has a political significance, as I was saying, because you get American boots on the ground, would be the term nowadays, actually in combat in North Africa. And that only happened at the expense of quite a lot of arguing and diplomacy, because the previous conferences back in 1942, Churchill and Roosevelt had discussed how the war should be fought. And they came up with the famous Germany First policy, which was the idea that the Americans would throw their effort behind the British to defeat Hitler first, and Japan would be not entirely on a back burner, but would be left less well-resourced until they dealt with Europe. And indeed, that's the way the war pans out. But having made that decision, the Americans then say, right, when are we going to invade France and invade Germany and crack straight on into the heart of the Reich and defeat the Nazis? And Churchill's argument is, we're not ready to do that yet. If Roosevelt had had his way, D-Day might have been in 1943. That was his position, was the Americans' position, was, let's get on with it. The British view, and this partly reflects the bitter experience of Dieppe in August 42, is they're not ready to invade mainland Europe, and it will take a bit longer. Churchill also has his Mediterranean strategy that has been driving British war plans since the mid-1930s, in fact. The idea that we have a much stronger strategic interest in the Mediterranean and Egypt and the defeat of Italy and all of that. And that won't necessarily be addressed by just attacking the Germans in France. So he is arguing that the Americans should wait and should continue to prosecute the campaign in the Mediterranean. And only when that is done will it be time to invade France.
And now to CBS in London. Bob Trout reporting.
London spent this Sunday trying to fit together the pieces of information, always so teasingly meager at the start of an operation. Allied headquarter announcements are released in Washington at the same time as here, but London is still getting most of the news of definite place names from Vichy Radio. And Vichy tells us the harbor and town of Algiers have been attacked, landings made and a foothold gained, and the situation is serious. 200 miles and more to the west, about halfway between Algiers and Gibraltar, the port of Oran has been attacked. Two places, a few miles on either side of Oran, have been occupied. That's the Mediterranean front. Around on the Atlantic coast, says Vichy, the airfield at the capital, Rabat, has been attacked from the air. Next most important port in Morocco, Casablanca, has been attacked from both air and sea. Vichy also reports landings at two places along the 60-mile stretch of coast between these two cities of Rabat and Casablanca. And some 140 miles farther down the Atlantic coast, an important force has been landed at Safi. Vichy Radio, heard in London, makes it clear that the Vichy government is still helping Germany. And Vichy complains that radio is being used as a weapon. They claim that secret radio stations are using the wavelengths of French North African stations. And they insist that General Giraud's spectacular broadcast was a fake. There is no reason at all to think it was a fake. And that's a very brief sketch of what London knows about the African operation so far.
15 sea miles off the key railroad city to the Moroccan interior lies the big task force of heavy U.S. naval units and packed transports. Carrier-based planes drone protectively overhead. When suddenly garrisons open fire. Orders to the United States Navy were to hold fire until fired upon. But now heavy gun turrets swing slowly toward Casablanca Harbor and let loose a roaring answer to Vichy. The attack has begun.
You then get the Casablanca Conference, famously, in January 43, where the leaders meet in the recently recaptured North Africa, and they have all this out over several weeks of negotiations. And it's tough negotiating. The Americans don't really trust the British they're negotiating with, and vice versa. And both sides are convinced the others are actually spying on them. But they do manage to sort of hammer out an agreement,
which
eventually.
Which they probably were. Good to know what the other guy's thinking when you're agreeing.
Exactly. And what that leads to is the decision to invade Sicily in the summer of 43 and go on ultimately to invade Italy as well, and to continue fighting that campaign through 1943 and to postpone what we know as D-Day, the invasion of Northern Europe, into 1944. So that's the sort of setting we're looking at that point. But it's an offensive decision. It's, you know, how can we win this now? It's not how can we avoid losing.
No, this is quite a different standpoint, isn't it? We're no longer on the back foot, really. Confidence was a vastly different thing among the Allies at the high level by now. I mean, Churchill and Roosevelt must have felt they actually were working towards what became D-Day, and that was the ultimate goal, wasn't it? Get in, strike.
They take a fairly crucial decision as well, which is that they will only accept unconditional surrender by the Germans. This is the idea that a negotiated peace which leaves the Germans with anything is no longer on the table. They will carry on fighting until Allied troops are in Berlin and the Nazi regime has been abolished. And that is quite an extreme war aim, if you like. It's not just about, you know, putting the Germans back in their box or defeating them. It's about absolutely crushing them and eliminating them.
It's quite ambitious. Because
it is ambitious.
It commits you to more war, doesn't it? To achieve that, but then to achieve something lesser than that. But, I mean, it was an extreme regime, wasn't it?
For 10 epoch-making days, Casablanca became the solar plexus of Anglo-American leadership. The Anfa Hotel was the meeting place when Premier Churchill and President Roosevelt, accompanied by the chiefs of staff of the two countries, laid plans for this year's offensive. The combined staffs were in almost constant session. Admiral of the Fleet Sir Dudley Pound, General Sir Alan Brooke, and Air Chief Marshal Sir Charles Portal for Britain, Admiral King, General Marshal, and General Arnold for the USA, Sir John Dill, General Somerville, Lord Louis Mountbatten, these and many others formed the imposing assembly which gathered in Casablanca. Mr. Churchill arrives for the press conference held in the grounds overlooking the Atlantic. At this informal meeting with the press, a new phrase was born: unconditional surrender for the Axis. What an indication of the heartening situation now prevailing. The Casablanca conference will greatly add to Germany's concern for the immediate future. In other words, they don't like the look of 1943 at all. They have reason to fear it. In the fourth year of war, it's the Allies and not the Axis who are demanding unconditional surrender. Germany faces invasion today, not Britain. The ring is closing in on the Reich, and there won't be much left of it when the smash comes. Between 20 and 30 Allied service chiefs have already made plans for moves which will spell crisis in Germany.
And the third partner in this equation, of course, is Stalin, is the Russians, who certainly, during 1942, Stalin feels that they're doing all the work, that the Allies aren't pulling their weight in the war. And the Second Front Now argument coming from Russia is very, very strong. That Stalin would like to see D-Day, you know, as soon as possible, and to see major ground troops fighting the Germans in the principal theatre of the war. Neither Churchill nor the Americans, well, the Americans more so, Churchill less so, want to do that. So they're trying to come up with solutions that will keep the Russians in the fight and, you know, keep Stalin happy as well. We take a very sort of Anglo-centric view in the UK, and Churchill's there saying before Alamein there was only defeat, after Alamein there was only victory. You can take out the word Alamein and insert the word Stalingrad, really, because the scale of the warfare is just completely different. If you look at the Africa Corps in North Africa, Rommel's forces, there are three German divisions fighting at El Alamein. At that point, there are more than 180 German divisions on the Eastern Front. So the scale of the thing is just completely different.
Die Schlacht Stalingrad. Feuer auf die Geschützfabrik Krasny Barrikad im Norden der Stadt.
Stalingrad.
Stuka greifen feindliche Batterien zwischen den Werkhallen an. Gefangene Bolschewisten, die aus Kellerlöchern und Bunkern herausgeholt wurden, werden zurückgebracht. Die blutigen Verluste des Feindes sind ungleich viel höher als die Zahl der Gefangenen.
The figures, when you look at Stalingrad, it's staggering. Up to 2 million people thought to have died in the run-up to it. It was 5 months of entrenched siege warfare, by the sounds of it. I mean, you tell me, you're the expert, but it sounds as though the end of that must have been a huge step into the sunlight.
Very much so. I mean, the campaign in Russia at that point, the Germans have very specific objectives, one of which is the Caucasus and the southern Russian oil fields. And the idea is that if they can capture that, not only will they deny all those resources to the Russians, but they will gain them for Germany. Because one of Germany's big problems is oil, rubber, all those kind of natural resources they don't have in Germany. So they come up with an operation, Case Blue, as it's called, Fallblau, which is an attack into the south of Russia with the aim of getting right through into the Caucasus and ultimately into northern Iran. And had that succeeded, it would have had a huge impact on the campaign. The problem with it was, as it rolled on, Stalingrad was not directly in the path of the offensive, slightly to the north, actually, but on the way, if you like. And Hitler, because of the name of the place as much as anything else, saw it as a real propaganda trophy. And, you know, Stalingrad had to be captured as part of this project. And when it doesn't fall in the first stages of the campaign, he diverts more and more resources to that operation at the expense of what the real objective is. And you end up in a situation where what should have been a big sort of mobile drive south gets, as you say, bogged down into what is basically a symbolic objective. I mean, capturing Stalingrad doesn't give them anything particularly.
It's not a political seat of power, particularly.
No, it's an industrial city, but its industry has mostly been moved east anyway.
Achtung, ich rufe noch einmal Stalingrad.
Hier ist Stalingrad. Hier ist die Front an der Wolga.
Achtung, noch einmal Leningrad.
Hier ist Front vor Leningrad und am Wolga.
Achtung, Catania. Hier ist die Mittelmeerfront und Afrika.
Carol came from some of the men of the 8th Army, and it was sung from the borders of Tripolitania. We've just pulled off the coast road that goes along there towards Sirte and ultimately to Tripoli, and over by our recording truck there have come one or two men of the 8th Army, and they're led by a corporal. I can see him there in his great coat and tin hat playing a clarinet, as you've just heard, and they've just been having a bit of a sing-song. As a matter of fact, they've been singing all kinds of songs with a bit of a difficulty in getting them to sing a carol at all, to be quite honest. And I don't want you to get the impression that the 8th Army is just having a nice picnic and is going gaily singing carols up the coast road after Rommel. They're not at all. They're far too busy fighting this war, and a grim enough business it is, and all this sand and dreary desert. We are a good way at the moment behind our forward troops, who certainly won't be going about caroling tonight. And Christmas, although it will be remembered and celebrated in the desert, won't, to be quite honest, be an affair of plum puddings and merry crackers and parties and good feasting for the men of the 8th Army.
it almost gains momentum, something like that, where troops are kind of becoming stranded and eventually becoming starved out. It becomes, I would imagine, harder to surrender, not easier.
Well, this is it. The battle develops its own momentum and it develops its own political momentum as well. Both sides focus in, because the Russians see the propaganda value of it as well, and both sides kind of focus in on this as a fight for a symbolic location, but also whoever wins is going to inflict a massive damage on the other. What the Germans arguably should have done was pull out and abandon it, but they've got so far in, both militarily and politically, they then can't do that. And the result is that von Paulus's 6th Army is completely surrounded by the Russians, and eventually the 6th Army has to surrender to the Russians. And at that point, the 6th Army alone has taken nearly 300,000 casualties. And that's dead and wounded, but also something like 100,000 people who go into Russian captivity at that point as prisoners of war. It's a massive blow to the German military. But you think, from the British perspective, El Alamein, there's only 50,000 Germans there in the first place. So the scale is quite different.
The streets of Stalingrad, if you can give the name to open spaces between ruins, still bear all the marks of battle. There's a usual litter of helmets and weapons, stacks of ammunition, papers fluttering in the snow, pocketbooks from dead Germans, and any number of smashed corpses lying where they fell, or stacked up in great frozen heaps for later burial. Stalingrad can never be repaired. It will have to be rebuilt from the beginning. But even though all its buildings are wrecked, there's life in it still. Along the narrow stretch of cement-coloured cliff by the river, which the Russians held through long months of assault, there's a city of dugouts. Dugouts occupied by the soldiers who've not yet left, and by a few women who stayed behind to launder and cook for the men. There's a real holiday atmosphere among these people today. They're the proudest men and women I've ever seen. They know they've done a terrific job and have done it well. Their city's been destroyed, but they've smashed the invader by sheer stubbornness and unconquerable courage. These men and women fought and worked for months with their backs to the river that they'd sworn never to retreat across, facing an enemy who held the only dominating height in Stalingrad and could pound them with shells and mortars unceasingly by day and night.
And what does Bletchley Park know about all of this while it's happening?
Bletchley Park is following the campaign on the Eastern Front, and with occasional bursts of sort of more detail. Bletchley's interest in the Eastern Front is strategic, and it's also about following what the Russians are doing, because the communications between the two are not brilliant. I mean, information is being shared with Stalin, but he doesn't necessarily believe it, and they're a bit wary about what they tell each other. But one of the things that does improve understanding of the Eastern Front, which happens in the course of 1943, is with the breaking of Fish, of the Lorenz traffic. Some of the networks that Bletchley are able to intercept and break there are strategic links to the headquarters of the German armies in Russia. So more information from that theatre will come in 1943. And one of the famous instances is before the Battle of Kursk, the German offensive at Kursk in the summer of 1943. That plan is given away by the Germans, if you like, in a Fish message that Bletchley breaks. That's something we can pick up on later in the year, nearer the time. But to go back to people's sort of perceptions of what was going on, the Germans, once Stalingrad goes against them, they initially try a sort of media blackout, but it's getting difficult because obviously so many people are involved, you can't cover the story up completely. By coincidence, the 30th of January 1943 is the 10th anniversary of Hitler's accession to power in 1933. And so you'd expect there to be major festivities. Hitler chose not to attend the commemorative event, if you like, and he had Goebbels read his speech for him on the radio, which shows sort of the quandary they're in, if you like, because they're trying to keep everybody motivated, but they're having to swallow an enormous loss. And the speech actually includes the phrase, "The heroic struggle of our soldiers on the Volga being the river in Stalingrad, the heroic struggle of our soldiers at the Volga should serve as a reminder to everyone that he must do his utmost in Germany's struggle for freedom." And that's kind of a veiled way of saying, we're going to have to try really hard now because we're not doing very well. I mean, they would never admit a defeat, but you can hear hints.
Struggle for freedom is an interesting phrase as well, as a concept, because the Allies see the Nazis as this force of evil. But obviously they didn't see it like that. They saw it as
a struggle for freedom.
That's
Hitler
very different.
Hitler sees the existential threat to the world is Bolshevism, is communism and the Russians. And so in his warped worldview, the evil is coming from the East. And he's in some ways, I don't know how you'd phrase it, he's disappointed by the attitude of the British and the Americans because in his worldview, they ought to be on his side. You know, they're not the real enemy. The real enemy is in the East. And it's becoming apparent at that point that whereas in 1941, early 42, they thought the Soviet Union was eminently beatable, and maybe in 1941 it was. But by 42, 43, the Russians have moved all their industry east. They're re-gearing up all their war economy, and they are becoming a real unstoppable force. And I think that fact is starting to dawn on the astute thinkers in Germany.
The triumphant conclusion of the Battle of Stalingrad, with the capture of 8 more German generals and 45,000 other prisoners in the past 2 days, has overshadowed the rest of the news from Russia. But our allies have kept up their great advance on the southern front. The programs of the German radio were interrupted this afternoon to broadcast the special communique. It was followed by sustained funeral drum rolls and by slow music, then by the national anthem and a 3-minute silence. A little later, it was announced that Goebbels had ordered all places of entertainment to be closed for 3 days. When this announcement was broadcast, it was followed by more slow music. It has also been announced that the whole public life of Germany for these 3 days will be given over to mourning. All radio programs are being changed.
One of the things that historians pick on in that period is Goebbels talking about the phrase total war, and this is a phrase that was coined in the First World War by the Germans to describe a conflict where you kind of go all out and you involve all of your society as a whole, be it working in factories, you know, being bombed, putting up with rationing, all of those sort of social aspects of being involved in a war, and throwing your whole country at the problem. Up until 1943, the Germans have tried to pretend that life in Germany can go on as usual, and that they are successful enough militarily that they don't need to completely gear up their economy to war and to dislocate people's normal civilian lives in that way.
Very different to here.
It's very different to here. In Britain, there was a realisation in 1940 that there's an existential threat and, you know, there's conscription and people working in factories and people getting bombed and everything else. The Germans had liked to maintain the illusion that that wasn't required in Germany. After 43, they have to basically announced to the population, we're in it for real now. We're neck deep in this. And they belatedly start really mobilising their economy in a way that they haven't up to that point. Fortunately for the Allies, by 1943, it's too late. But also the Allied bombing campaign through 1943 really gets going as well. And so the German population start to feel the effects of the war much more directly. It's interesting that if you look at the attitudes of the different belligerents to the employment of women, for example, the Soviets used huge numbers of women in all different... They had women driving tanks and flying planes and things from quite early in the war. Britain has conscription for women after 1942 and they're involved in industry and they're massively represented at Bletchley Park, but they're not necessarily fighting on the front line. The Germans are hamstrung by their own politics, which say that the woman's place is very much in the home. And you get the Kinderküche, Kirche, you know, children, kitchen and church is the phrase, that's women's role. And so it goes against their political rhetoric to then turn around to all these German women and say, actually, you've got to fight in a factory or man a flat gun or whatever it is. They're not able to mobilise their population in the same way because it goes against the politics they're trying to preach.
Es will nicht den totalen Krieg, sagen die Engländer, sondern die Kapitulation.
Ja!
Wollt ihr den totalen Krieg?
Ja!
Wollt ihr ihn, wenn nötig, totaler und radikaler, als wir ihn für uns heute überhaupt erst vorstellen können?
Ja!
Ich frage euch, seid ihr entschlossen, dem Führer in der Erkämpfung des Sieges durch dick und dünn und unter Aufnahme auch der schwersten persönlichen Belastungen zu folgen?
Ja.
move back to Bletchley Park and look at what was happening there. It was January 1943, and there'd just been the break back into naval Enigma after the fourth rotor had been added and the great bravery of the submarine being boarded by the three young sailors who got the treasures out, and two of them lost their lives. And they never knew the importance of what they got, but they got it out. Gosh, did it make a difference? Let's start there.
Absolutely. I mean, U-559 is the operation you're talking about that happens in October 42. And the problem with the four rotor Enigma, they understand the machine from late 1941 at Bletchley Park. But what you need to get into it properly is cribs, which are, you know, guessable messages, basically. And the submarines that are using the system are also using a code book that allows them to compress their messages into a much shorter format. And one of the things that comes from U-559 is a copy of that code book, which allows the German messages to be predicted much more easily. And so that basically allows Hut 8 back into Shark, as the Enigma key is called. And they start reading U-boat traffic very successfully after that.
Blocked out for 10 months by then, haven't they?
Yes.
Devastating, yes, most of 1942. Yeah.
But the picture changes substantially in 1943 because Bletchley is working on a four-drum bomb machine, which will come into service in April of 1943. December 1942, January 43, Alan Turing is actually in the US. He's in Dayton, Ohio, advising the US bomb project. And they build a four-drum machine in the cash register factory in Dayton. And they are set up in Washington, D.C. And that's so successful that by the end of 43 into 44, U-boat traffic is being processed almost exclusively in the United States.
Dawn, 30th of October, 1942. A periscope and the outline of a submarine are spotted by a Royal Air Force patrol aircraft in the eastern Mediterranean. This sighting will be a vital turning point at Bletchley Park. For 10 devastating months, the codebreakers have been working under a complete blackout of U-boat communications. The German Navy have introduced a new layer of encryption to their Enigma machine, a fourth rotor. HMS Batard and three other warships are on the scene by 10 a.m. and spend the next 10 hours hunting and depth-charging the U-boat. Night has fallen when the submarine is finally forced to surface after sustaining serious damage. Chaotic scenes unfold as the enemy crew start to abandon ship. Knowing the U-boat could contain vital intelligence which could be utilized by the Allies, Tanny Fasson, the first lieutenant on Petard, and able seaman Colin Grazier immediately leap into the sea and swim through a mass of fleeing U-boat men towards the U-559. They are followed by Naffy canteen assistant Tommy Brown. Cold and wet, Fasson and Grazier board the submarine, climbing down the conning tower into the blackness below. Time is running out for the men, who are frantically collecting the priceless books and documents on the U-boat. Whilst the U-boat is gradually filling with water, the two men hand various Enigma treasures to Brown, who, after exploring the engine and control room, has positioned himself on the U-boat's conning tower. "Abandon ship!" Brown screams, and plunges into the dark waters to be rescued by the boat crew. At that moment, the ill-fated U-boat suddenly takes in an enormous amount of water and rapidly sinks, taking Tony Fasson and Colin Grazier with it. The bodies of Fasson and Grazier were never recovered. Almost certainly they drowned, trapped in the sinking submarine. The demand for intelligence was never more closely linked to individual sacrifice, but the two men did not die in vain. Just 3 weeks later, The documents taken from the U-559, including the U-boat's short signal and weather signal codebooks, arrived at Bletchley Park. This pinch provided Bletchley Park codebreakers with a priceless tool to help break the four-rotor enigma. Within an hour of breaking Shark, the U-boat code, 15 U-boat positions were identified, and Bletchley Park was able to read naval traffic and crack enigma codes for the remainder of the war. This enabled the Admiralty to reroute the vital convoys to and from the USA, saving thousands of tons of shipping and countless lives.
And that brings us to the other aspect of what happens in 43, is we've talked about Churchill and Roosevelt not necessarily agreeing at Casablanca, but that is the surface of a much deeper agreement. They are actually fundamentally on the same side. And that's reflected at Bletchley in the sense that the Americans don't try and go their own way and create a whole separate signals organization. Now they're involved in the battle, they would have had an argument for saying, we now need to do our own intelligence because we've got our own soldiers involved. And the argument up to late 1942 was, you don't need your own intelligence operation because your soldiers aren't involved. But after Torch, they are. But various agreements are negotiated in the course of 1943 that allow American personnel to be integrated really seamlessly into the Bletchley Park operation. And that is one of the fundamental aspects of why Bletchley and Government Code and Cipher School was so successful in the Second World War, is this international cooperation that takes place, and the fact that the one institution is serving all the Allied commanders, regardless of their nationality, really. And that's marked with the invasion of Sicily in July, that Patton, who is commanding the American troops there, starts to get ultra messages direct from Bletchley Park. And so it's not just that we're sharing the intelligence with the US War Department or with the government there. We're just sending it direct to their general in the field without anybody sort of interfering in that chain.
He will have known the provenance of it. He wouldn't have had any worries about sort of, should I trust this information? He'd have known where it came from.
Yes, and he was very keen on it. You know, he was quite happy to receive it, which is ironic. In Montgomery, he was much less of an enthusiast for Ultra than Patton was.
Yesterday afternoon at about 4:30, the war in North Africa came to an end. Early on Tuesday morning, the Axis armies were cut clean in half by the British drive across the neck of the Cape Bon Peninsula. That left mainly the German 90th Light Division to be accounted for, a division of tough veteran fighting troops, some of the finest fighters that ever came out of Germany. In the mountains, they went on fighting until they had little ammunition left. Our troops in the north put down a smoke screen, and under cover of it, they withdrew a little while our bombers went in three deadly waves to deliver the last aerial bombardment and one of the heaviest of the whole campaign. When our bombers had finished, our artillery opened up, and soon hundreds of white flags were appearing all over the place.
All of this growth and development is physically reflected at Bletchley Park as well, isn't it? Tell us a bit about that.
Well, from the beginning of 1942, they have had a building program to sort of replace the huts. And that's partly born out of the famous letter from the codebreakers.
Just to explain what the letter was, some cheeky young upstarts who were fairly high up in the codebreaking echelons at Bletchley Park decided to write directly to Churchill for more resources. So this was Alan Turing, Gordon Welchman, Hugh Alexander, and they sent Stuart Milner Barry as the young one, kind of drew the short straw to go and deliver it, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
And in it, they asked very specifically for more resources, and it was quite, some of it seemed quite pedestrian, sort of more girls for the typing pool and things like that. But it made all the difference because it actually got to Churchill, and he very much believed in the importance and power of intelligence coming from Bletchley Park. And it turned the tide in terms of investment, and there's a memo, isn't there? Give them what they need and let me know it's been done.
Dear Prime Minister, some weeks ago you paid us the honour of a visit, and we believe that you regard our work as important. You will have seen that, thanks largely to the energy and foresight of Commander Travis, we've been well supplied with the bombs for the breaking of the German Enigma codes. We think, however, that you ought to know that this work is being held up, and in some cases is not being done at all, principally because we cannot get sufficient staff to deal with it. Our reason for writing to you direct is that for months we have done everything that we possibly can through the normal channels, and that we despair of any early improvement without your intervention. No doubt in the long run, these particular requirements will be met. But meanwhile, still more precious months will have been wasted, and as our needs are continually expanding, we see little hope of ever being adequately staffed. We realize that there is a tremendous demand for labor of all kinds and that its allocation is a matter of priorities. The trouble, to our mind, is that as we are a very small section with numerically trivial requirements, it is very difficult to bring home to the authorities finally responsible either the importance of what is done here or the urgent necessity of dealing promptly with our requests. At the same time, we find it hard to believe that it is really impossible to produce quickly the additional staff that we need, even if this meant interfering with the normal machinery of allocations. We have written this letter entirely on our own initiative. We do not know who or what is responsible for our difficulties, and most emphatically, we do not want to be taken as criticizing Commander Travis, who has all along done his utmost to help us in every possible way. But if we are to do our job as well as it could and should be done, it is absolutely vital that our wants, small as they are, should be promptly attended to. We have felt that we should be failing in our duty if we did not draw your attention to the facts and to the effects which they are having and must continue to have on our work unless immediate action is taken. We are, sir, your obedient servants, Turing, Welchman, Alexander, Milner Barry.
From that point on, they were able to develop Bletchley Park in a way that they hadn't been able to before. With that came greater need, I should imagine.
And that flows through 1942. You see blocks A and B down the side of the lake opened, and that's naval section and initially air section in there as well.
So that's blocks, big brick, solid buildings that you couldn't bomb very easily. I've got big, thick concrete roofs. These days you can't get phone signal in them, for example. This is as opposed to wooden huts being thrown up in the grounds of an old country house. This shows the commitment, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And they go through an intermediate phase where they build reinforced buildings for machinery, but they keep people in wooden huts.
Like the bomb hut.
Like the bomb hut. But then at this point, they're building the blocks. The clue's in the letters, because A and B are built in 1942, and then D, E, F, and G open in 1943, and we go on to have a block H as well. So there's this huge expansion. The key building, in many ways, is block D, which is one of the largest, and that opens in 43. And what they do in there is they take hut 6, hut 8, and hut 3, which are the core Enigma activities. So hut 6 is Army and Air Force Enigma decryption, hut 8 is naval decryption, hut 3 is the intelligence half of hut 6. And all of those people are put into one massive block. And latterly, SIXTA, which is the Traffic Analysis Organization, is incorporated in there as well. So all of those organizations, which work very closely together anyway, are all amalgamated in one building, and there's a conveyor belt system to carry the paperwork around the building, and there's a tunnel under the road with a conveyor belt linking it to block E, which has all the teleprint equipment in it.
So there was a tunnel?
There is a tunnel, yes. A very short, small tunnel.
Could you walk down it, or is it just for...
It's about 4 foot square, and it's got 2 foot of water in it at the moment.
I thought that the tunnel theory was a theory, because the way inside block D, that you go down some steps and it sort of goes down from ground level to slightly lower. It's obviously been dug in to the ground.
I had a lady who worked in it in the 1970s saying to me, oh yes, it was partially underground, because you come in and it's actually built down the slope of the hill.
I see.
So it's all above ground, but if it was blacked out and you went in, you would go in and then you'd go down a series of flights of stairs and you would think you were descending into the bowels of the earth. Actually, you're just following the natural slope of the hill. But we have all sorts of rumours and myths about tunnels that, you know, Churchill might have gone to the pub down or whatever.
Lucky at time.
Yeah, exactly. But there is one tunnel to satisfy the curious. It's about 10 metres long and it goes under the road from block E and pops up in block D. As I understand it, it was a sort of, if you imagine a bicycle chain with bulldog clips attached to it, you could kind of attach paperwork on and it would be carried through. But apparently it wasn't very reliable and they would have to send one of the smaller members of staff down it periodically to crawl along and pick up all the bits of paper that had fallen off.
Oh my goodness. It's an upgrade on the broom handle and the tray between huts 3 and 6, isn't it?
It's very similar. We talk about the industrialisation of the site, and this is one of the real examples of it. Block D becomes this, you know, it must have 500 or 600 people working in it.
And it gets very confusing. I remember veterans who will just rock up for a day out at Bletchley Park and they would say, I worked in Hut 6, dear. And you'd take them to Hut 6. Well, not here, dear. They'd say, no, it was a solid building, and they'd be genuinely confused. But actually, it was because they were in Block D by then. But it was still called Hut 6 because that was the name of the department, the function.
Yes.
So, yeah, it gets very confusing. But it was much more factory-like by this time and needed that kind of space and automation.
One of the interesting things, we have the paperwork of a organisation called the Western Front Committee that was set up in November 42. And at that point, there's a recognition that the invasion of France is going to come at some point. And so Bletchley set up a programme to collect all the intelligence they think might be relevant to an invasion. And they take over one of the rooms initially in Block B. And Diana Pears, who was the secretary of the Scottish Dancing Club, is put in charge of this room. And basically what they're doing is every fortnight they have a meeting and all of the various heads come together and they bring any intelligence information they think would be relevant to the upcoming invasion. And they collate it onto wall maps, they have order of battle diagrams, they have filing cabinets. Basically all this data is being stored and collated. And that's from end of 42, beginning of 43. And at that point, although they don't know it, the invasion is 18, 20 months away. But it shows the depth of detail of effort that they're already systematically collecting information, updating and collating. And because the paperwork of the fortnightly meetings survives in our archives, it's really interesting reading because you can see their understanding of the Germans in France evolving and developing, you know, fragment by fragment, piece by piece. By the time you get to June 1944, their understanding of the Germans in France is more or less complete. They know everything by that point. And that's been achieved through more than 18 months of patient, diligent collection work.
The African war is over. Mussolini's African empire and Corporal Hitler's strategy are alike exploding. One continent, at least, has been cleansed and purged forever from fascist or Nazi tyranny. The proud German army has, by its sudden collapse, its sudden crumpling and breaking up, unexpected to all of us, the proud German army has once again proved the truth of the saying, the Hun is always either at your throat or your feet. I do not intend to be responsible for any suggestion that the war is won or that it will soon be over. That it will be won by us, I am sure. But how and when cannot be foreseen, still less foretold. By singleness of purpose, by steadfastness of conduct, by tenacity and endurance, such as we have so far displayed, by these, and only by these, can we discharge our duty to the future of the world and to the destiny of man.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and Catherine White and supported by Audio Boom. If you like this podcast, don't be shy, write us a ripping review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.